All right. We have been, as you know, looking at 20 indications for why we really earnestly and honestly believe that this is the last generation. We are that last generation before the coming of Jesus Christ. And I am against my normal way of doing things. I'm actually trying to go back over my notes and put them in some sort of a typed up, organized category. I mean, normally they're, you know, it's like this. And I have piles and files and a big, huge folder just on the Wednesday night, on this Wednesday night study. And I really feel I need to get it all into typed up, printed form and put it on our website and make it available to you. So I've been trying to do that. And but in like going back over it and typing it up, I always make the same mistake. I start looking over it again and then you think of something else and then you remember another verse and then you look up something else and now it's like it's growing. But anyway, I'm not going to give you any more stuff except for this. I typed my list up. I even added the last four or five things that we have here that we are going to start on a new subject tonight. But I was looking back and typing my notes up on what was point number one, which is to me the most miraculous evidence that this is the time of the Lord's return, and it's probably the one really truly miraculous thing that any Christian could point to. If anybody ever asks you about a miracle, and that has to be the existence of the nation of Israel, right? There's no doubt about that. That's a fulfillment of prophecy, and that's a miracle that you can't explain the fact that that nation is there. No other nation in history has ever gone out of existence for almost 2,000 years and then come back into existence. That's never happened. Not one nation. And especially a nation that was persecuted and nearly annihilated on a number of occasions. But in going back over that and typing my notes up and just looking to clarify dates and details and things like that, I came across this little detail about that, which to me just blessed my heart. And that is, on the night that Israel became a nation in 1948, or at least the night that they announced it, which was May the 14th, 1948. They had planned to announce this in Israel, in Tel Aviv, at midnight. That was 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. our time here. 6 months before that, in November, November the 29th, is when the United Nations voted to make it possible for Israel to become a nation. They voted on a resolution. The UN was a brand new institution at that time, because the UN was created right after World War II. And so this was 1947, just a couple of years after World War II. The UN is, you know, hasn't yet, you know, it's just still sort of in its own infancy. And so they voted on November 29th, the UN voted on a resolution to partition the land of Palestine. Because the Jews and the Arabs and Palestinians there had been fighting back and forth for years and years and years. I mean, there were all kinds of skirmishes and little battles that were taking place almost every week for generations. And so the situation was very controversial. No one had a solution. There were political interests on both sides, and this is immediately after World War II. So the world was just very briefly sympathetic toward the Jewish, you know, situation because of all the Jews that had died in the Holocaust. But for the most part, had it not been for the Holocaust, our nation was not very kind to the Jews. I mean, maybe individually, but our politicians were not, especially the president that was in office at that time in World War II, right at the end of World War II, was Franklin Roosevelt, FDR. He was an anti-Semite. And there's a lot of information on that now that I ended up spending some time reading and studying since last Wednesday night. But he was he hated the Jews. And there were numerous comments that he made that are in not in speeches, but in private, to individuals who recorded it and reported it later. And he was also opposed to the Jews having a home in Israel. So as World War II was winding down, there was, if you remember your history, the war wasn't actually over yet until that summer, but in February, there was a big conference in Yalta, in Crimea, and it involved Roosevelt, Churchill, representing England, and Stalin, representing Russia. So these three, the big three, they met at Yalta to discuss, even before the war was over, how they were going to divide up the spoils, in a sense. How they were going to divide up Europe, what they were going to do with the Middle East. They were already beginning to lay the plans for that before the war was even over. And at that conference, now Roosevelt was already sick, but at that conference, it was reported and it's recorded and you can look it up. Roosevelt meant, this is February of 1945, Roosevelt mentioned to Stalin that in a couple of weeks he was going to be meeting the king of Saudi Arabia. He had corresponded with him. His name was Ibn Saud, and he was the founder of Saudi Arabia, named after his family, his dynasty. And Roosevelt had been corresponding with him for a couple of years over the Jewish problem, as they called it. And obviously, Ibn Saud, the king of Saudi Arabia, had a hatred of the Jewish people. And at that time, in the 1940s, there's still this great immigration of Jews coming into the Middle East. And the Arabs all around them are trying to do everything they can to undermine this, to stop it. And so Ibn Saud and Roosevelt had been corresponding for some time. And at Yalta, Roosevelt said to Stalin that he was going to be meeting Ibn Saud in the very, very near future. In fact, from Yalta, he went to that meeting. They met in Egypt on a naval destroyer. But at the comment that he made to Stalin asked him, he said, "Well, do you plan to make any concessions to the king?" And Roosevelt's words were this: "There's only one concession that I would like to make, and I'm thinking about offering him the 6 million Jews in America." Now, at that time, Roosevelt had knowledge of the death camps in Germany and in Poland. And by that time, the news wasn't, it wasn't all verified yet because, we hadn't won the war and gone in there to be able to see and examine everything. But Auschwitz had already been liberated by February of 1945. And they had already seen the horrors of Auschwitz, and they knew that Jews were being slaughtered by the hundreds and hundreds of thousands. He might not have known that number, 6 million, but it's kind of interesting that 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust, and Roosevelt, when asked, "What would you like to give the king of Saudi Arabia?" "I'd like to give him the 6 million Jews in the United States." Roosevelt was dead 2 months later. At that meeting, by the way, that he had with King Saud, he made a verbal promise, and it was recorded. It became the policy of the United States for the next 2 years. But he made a promise to the King of Saud not to do anything to support the Jewish claim to a home in the Middle East. So, what did your Heavenly Father do? He removed Roosevelt. Do you know who Roosevelt's vice president was at that time? Harry Truman. A born-again Christian who knew his Bible and loved the Jewish people. God is in control. God is in control. In fact, Harry Truman grew up in a Baptist Sunday school when he was a kid, and he claimed to, I don't know anything about his spiritual life, but he claimed to be a believer. He claimed to be a born-again Christian. And after the death of Roosevelt and Truman was, Truman came to power, he still inherited all of Roosevelt's administration, who were all liberal, communist sympathizers with the Arab issue. So he surrounded all of his cabinet people, including Dean Rusk, George Marshall, who was the Secretary of State. George Marshall is the guy that came up with the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe after World War II. And Truman had a lot of respect for Marshall. In fact, he considered him the greatest living American. That's what he said of him. George Marshall was his Secretary of State. George Marshall was an anti-Semite and hated the Jewish people, too. And he was absolutely violently, vocally outspoken against any kind of a home for the Jews in the Middle East. But as the date neared for the Jews, it was well known around the world that Israel intended on that date, May the 14th, 1948, to declare themselves a nation. That date was significant because that's when the British mandate, the British were in control of the Middle East. The UN had given them that authority over the Middle East, but that mandate ended at midnight on May the 14th, 1948. And so the Jews had made it clear that when that mandate ends and British authority is over, we're proclaiming ourselves a nation. So a lot of the governments around the world were scrambling, trying to figure out what they were going to do because everybody anticipated like World War III breaking out, you know, as soon as this happens. And all of Truman's advisors, except for one, were violently against us recognizing that new government in Israel. And but Truman wanted to do it. There was a meeting on May the 14th in the White House, just a few hours before, you know, at 6 p.m. on our time is when it would have taken place. And so that afternoon at like 4 o'clock, 4:30, Truman gathered all of his advisors together, and they were all against it, vehemently against it. Truman had expressed his desire that he wanted to, as soon as Israel makes that announcement, we're going to be the first nation to recognize them as a legitimate country immediately. And in fact, George Marshall told him that if you do that, Mr. President, if you run for election the next time, I won't vote for you. And was going to vocally make it clear that the State Department opposed this move. And his Secretary of War, Secretary of Defense, all these guys that are in this meeting, everybody's against it except for one advisor. And that advisor knew the president's feelings on it and prepared a tremendous, like, short little presentation as to why Israel should be recognized as a country. It caused a great argument, a big fight in the office. People stomped out. It's now just an hour and a half or 2 hours before the announcement is supposed to be made. And I read that man that was there, the man that was in favor of it, his name was Clark Clifford. He wrote a book about it called Showdown in the Oval Office, and it was about that incident, this showdown. It was the most controversial thing in Truman's administration, was what to do about Israel becoming a nation. And but he said that right up until the last minute, there was all this sort of this intrigue going back and forth, phone calls going back and forth, until finally, like literally moments before 6 p.m., Truman made the decision that he was going to do it. He didn't care who was against it or for it. And so the announcement was made at the UN and was reported to the media. And there was like instant shock among, you know, in the government that we had supported that. But obviously in Israel, we vocalized our support for them 11 minutes after they announced it. So that was a blessing. 6:11 p.m., Truman made the announcement. A couple of months after he got out of the presidency, he was invited to a Jewish theological seminary here in New York, and he was supposed to be meeting some dignitaries from Israel, from the new country of Israel. And one of them was David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister of Israel. And at that meeting with these dignitaries, he was introduced as the man who helped create Israel. And Truman was a very humble man, and so he objected to that. He said, no. He said, I am Cyrus. I am Cyrus. And it was, and that was the quote that was attributed to him in the newspapers, that he likened himself to Cyrus. And if you've read your Bible, you know what Cyrus did. Cyrus was simply that Gentile who made the, you know, who made the decree and made it possible for Israel to once again become a nation. But anyway, but what blessed my heart about it is, like, you know, you say, we don't always see the miraculous, the stuff that goes on behind the scenes, how the Lord sets up one and removes another, and God is orchestrating things, even in all these places of power, just so that His will is accomplished. So the fact that Israel became a nation that night and the way that it happened, and the fact that the very next day, five nations around them declared war on them. They went to war the very next day. Israel at that time had an army of 16,000 soldiers. There was a combined force in those five nations of 500,000 soldiers. So it was 500,000 to 16,000. And Israel only owned at that time 10,000 rifles. So they've got 10,000 guns against the armies of five nations, and the Lord allowed them to be victorious. Anyway, all right, so that's sort of going backwards, but I just get such a blessing when you find out those things and you see the hand of God in this, and it just confirms that the Lord is certainly moving and setting things in place, and we're very closely, we're getting very close to that day when the Lord's coming is going to be upon us. All right, so anyway, but that was number one, and if you remember, the massive immigration of Jews back to Israel was number two, the land of Israel blossoming like a garden, number three, number four was biblical cities being rebuilt, five, the resurrection of the Hebrew language for the Jewish people. It was a dead language for many centuries. Number six, the return of the shekel as the unit of currency in Israel. Number seven, the armies of Israel being victorious in all their wars thus far. Number eight was the fact of great towers, skyscrapers, rising around the world, because the Bible says that in the day of the Lord the towers would fall, so there needed to be towers, and they're here. And most of which, by the way, are in Muslim countries. The tallest of those towers are all in Muslim countries. Number nine, the falling away among Christianity. Number ten, the proliferation of false Bibles. Number 11, the growth of the ecumenical movement. Number 12, the formation of the European Union. Number 13, the sudden rise of violent anti-Semitism all around the world. Number 14, the moral collapse of America. The sex, the violence, the drugs, the anarchy that we see here in our own country. Number 15, which we're going to finally finish. There's so much more I want to do on it, but we're going to turn the page. Number 15 was the rise of militant Islam. All right. The next two, and I might do two in one night. All right. The next two I want to talk about are number one, or number 16 would be, I couldn't think of an adjective strong enough to describe this. I put insane in my notes, but there's probably, and it's not very, it's probably not the right word. But we want to look at the increase, the dramatic, insane increase in technology in this generation. I mean, that's pretty obvious. Some of the things that every young person in here takes for granted because they've been a part of your life since you were born really have all come into existence since some of the older folks in here were born. So the things that you and I take for granted that we seem like we can't live without, that today business can't function without, have all come into existence in this generation. Not 300 years ago, 200 years ago, but in the last 50 or 60 years, these things are now so much a part of our life that we can't even imagine life without them. And all right now, like right here in this generation. And the Bible obviously prophesied these things, and that's what we're going to look at tonight. And if we have time, we're going to go on to number 17, and that is I won't tell you just in case we don't get there, because I might not get there. Okay, let's try to finish this one, though, tonight if we can. All right, let's go to Daniel chapter 12. If anybody can think of a better word than insane, I don't know. That came to my mind. But the insane increase in technology that is taking over our lives. And that all plays a part in the Antichrist's final kingdom. Because if he's going to be able to control a global economy, there has to be a means to do that. There has to be a means for him to control your pocketbook and be able to dictate and control whether you can buy or sell. And so this needed to happen. Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12. Go down to verse 2. I think is where I want. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end, which, by the way, is an expression, and I think I mentioned this a couple of Wednesday nights ago, that little expression, the time of the end, is found here in the book of Daniel. I think it's four or five times, and it all refers to the same thing, which would be the time of the tribulation. That is the time of the end that the book of Daniel is pointing toward. It's not talking about the end of the world and the great white throne judgment, but the time of the end is that time of tribulation when these things in the book of Daniel are all going to be fulfilled. So notice it says that the book of Daniel is shut up and sealed. In other words, the Spirit of God did not choose to give a good understanding of these things because it wasn't necessary 300, 400 years ago for anybody to understand these prophecies. All right, but at the time of the end, then these things become clearer and clearer. The closer we get to that time when these things are going to be fulfilled, I think is that the Lord would give the body of Christ more and more understanding of these things. Sometimes it takes circumstances, you know, it takes the events around you to be able to put, you know, two and two together when it comes to prophecy. But certainly we see the circumstances unfolding all around us, and the book of Daniel is going to play an important part in understanding the times that we live in. But verse 4, it says, "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." Knowledge shall be increased. Normally, you know, from the time you're little to the time you get old, knowledge increases. So that's a natural part of life. You should be getting a little smarter, a little wiser. But for this to have like prophetic implications means that there would be an explosion of knowledge, a dramatic increase in knowledge, almost as if it were a sign, a symbol, some sort of an indication that that time of the end was approaching, that people would run to and fro. You can probably imagine what that might be speaking about, can't you? I mean, travel. I mean, you can run literally from one side of the globe to the other by tomorrow morning. To go back to the thing about Roosevelt and Ibn Saud, I read a transcript of written by one of the Navy officers that was on that ship where this meeting took place between Ibn Saud and the president. And Ibn Saud and his entourage were taken on 2 days before, taken onto the ship in the Red Sea, 2 days before Roosevelt arrived. And Ibn Saud, the king of Saudi Arabia, at that time, the oil in Saudi Arabia was still owned by American companies, so the wealth that they have now wasn't, you know, they didn't realize they had that much wealth in 1947, 48. And so he was ruling over Saudi Arabia at that time, was a very poor and backward country. Ibn Saud had never been out of Saudi Arabia until that point. And so a lot of the things that he was seeing on this battleship, he was seeing for the very first time. He had never, in other words, he'd lived almost like a Bedouin in the desert, and he's the king of an entire country, but it was a very backward country. He was very ignorant of things going on. Is that why this is going in and out? Okay, thank you. Okay, that's better. So, even a lot of the knowledge that you and I have about the world, about events, about science, health, it's because it's more and more, it's right at your fingertips. And so now there has been an explosion of knowledge in these last days, and that, I believe, is also a fulfillment. As we get right up close to that time of the end, that's exactly what we're seeing. Your phone, which you are so enamored with right now, is going to be obsolete by the end of next year, and you're going to have to buy a new one. You know, you get a computer and you spend, there was a time now you can pick up a laptop for $500, but I can remember when they were $1,000, $1,200, $1,400 a few years ago, and the thing was almost obsolete 2 years later. The technology is increasing, the speeds are increasing, whatever, you know, the clarity, everything. You know, you got to have the next new thing. In our lifetime, think about just the little things of technology that have changed in our lifetimes. Your television, for example. Now, I'm going to really date myself, but I can remember a big, gigantic wooden box in our living room and a little screen, black and white screen like this. Now, I'm really ancient. You can see that now. But I remember that. And I remember like, being so amazed at the technology. This was like, I remember my father and mother telling me, like, when TVs first came out, which were in our generation, right after they were invented before World War II, but nobody really had them until after World War II, is when they became, you know, economical enough for families to buy them. And then after World War II, late 40s, early 50s, then people began, you know, putting them in their homes. And I remember my dad telling me when the first television set came to his neighborhood, and the family that bought it, they were the only people around that had one of these things, and everybody flocked to their house to go and look at this box with this little 8-inch screen, this little thing like this, and you couldn't even really tell what was going on. But it was just this amazing. Now you're watching TV and watching movies on your cell phone. Now you can download. We take it for granted because, everybody, 10-year-olds have got them now. And it's because, I guess, we need to, like, put ourselves back 70 or 80 years to see the contrast in what that generation had to compare to what we have. But it's so obvious that there's an explosion of knowledge. A dramatic, insane increase in the technology, but it's slowly, maybe not so slowly, taken over our lives. You can't imagine living without it now. I remember for a few years, we just, because of various reasons, we decided not to have a TV. We could afford one, but we decided not to. Do you know how weird that looked to everybody we knew? You guys don't have a television? As if it was a part of being a born-again Christian, you're part of a cult because you don't have a TV. We can't imagine doing without some of the things right now that we are so dependent on. And that is a part of just knowing that we are that close to the coming of Jesus Christ, because that knowledge, that worldwide, global, instantaneous, crystal clear knowledge that everybody has access to within a few moments, is going to be a part. It was necessary for it to be here for the Antichrist to be able to do several things that I'm going to show you. First of all, here's one thing that would not have been possible were it not for modern technology. Go to Revelation chapter 11. Revelation chapter 11 just describes that time in the tribulation when those two witnesses, Moses and Elijah, are both there in Jerusalem preaching for 3.5 years. Revelation 11 describes their ministry and how they just stand there through the tribulation preaching the gospel of the kingdom. And it says, after a while, the Lord allows them to be killed. It says in verse number 7, and when they shall have finished their testimony. So the Lord had a reason for them being there for 3.5 years preaching the gospel, being hated by the world, and they are hated, because if you look down at the bottom of verse number 10, everybody's excited and gives each other gifts and rejoices when they're finally killed, because in the end of verse 10 it says, because these two prophets tormented them that dwelt on the earth. What are they doing? They're preaching. That's the way the world reacts to preaching, honest, straightforward preaching. They think they're being tormented. And they considered themselves tormented because God allows these two preachers, Moses and Elijah. I hope we get to see that and hear that. I know we're going to be in heaven at that time, but I hope somehow there's a link or HDMI cord or something like that hooked to the screens in heaven. I want to be able to see how much we need it. I want to be able to see on that technology in heaven to be able to see. Imagine the Lord could do that without any cords and without any computers. But can you imagine Elijah and Moses preaching for that 3.5 year period in Jerusalem? And at the end, when they finish their testimony, they can't be killed. They're impervious to harm until they're finished with their testimony, just like me and you. Right? You can't be harmed until God's finished with you. That should be encouraging to you. Helps you not to be afraid in a situation. Because no harm can come to a child of God until the Lord is finished, until you've finished your testimony. And that's what happens here. When they're done, then it says that the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. They just leave the bodies laying in the streets. You've seen that on the news in Fallujah and other places. When some of our soldiers and others are killed, it's a pretty big deal to Islam to parade around their victims. And, you know, they want that out there. They want people to see that. They hung the bodies in Fallujah from the bridge and left them there for several days. And so here, these two bodies are just left in the streets because the Antichrist and his government are glorying in the fact that they were finally able to kill them. And it says, and they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3 days and a half, and shall not suffer their dead bodies to be put in graves. And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them, make merry, and shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwelt on the earth. And then verse 11, and after 3 days and a half, the spirit of life from God entered into them, so they're resurrected. And they're resurrected right on, live on camera, because if the whole world can see their bodies there, it says the whole world is looking at their bodies there, how would that have been possible without television? It wouldn't have been possible. So the whole world is watching it. The whole world is rejoicing. It looks like it might have been Christmas time when they're killed, because everybody's giving them gifts, giving gifts to one another. But whenever it is, there's just a worldwide global party when these two prophets are killed, and everybody's watching it at the same time, and they're rejoicing. And then it looks like right on live television, after 3 days and a half, the spirit of life from God enters into them. They stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them, so on and so forth. Now, this is right at the end of the tribulation, just before Jesus Christ comes. But there's obviously the technology had to be invented so that this could be visible all the way around the world. That technology wasn't available when this book was written, or it wasn't available until just 50 years ago. So in this generation, that technology and that knowledge, that explosion of knowledge, is absolutely an indication that we are this close to the coming of the Lord. Go back with me to the book of Genesis and look at I'm going to look at something here, because this was an element of Nimrod's kingdom as well. And Nimrod in the Old Testament is a prototype of the coming Antichrist. He's a picture. He's a pretty good picture of what the Antichrist is going to look like. There are a number of men like that in the Scriptures, where when you look at their life, in fact, 18, I think, there's 18 individuals in the Bible whose lives actually represent, or they're a picture of, the coming Antichrist. Nimrod is probably one of the clearest ones. But notice that before Nimrod came to power, God had made a promise to Noah right after the flood. In Genesis chapter 9, it says, God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. The exact same words God had said to Adam. And God intended to fill the earth in the days of Adam and Eve with a race of people that were in the image of God. And of course, Adam sinned, and so that plan went down the drain, and the Lord had to step in and redeem the human race. But in the days of Noah, God still wanted Noah and his descendants to replenish the earth, not all to stay and build houses and start a city on the top of Mount Ararat, where they had landed, but to scatter and to fill the earth with their descendants. And God had wanted that. But so it's obvious that in order for the earth to be replenished, Noah and his descendants needed to spread out. They needed to move in all directions back around the globe to do that. But in chapter 10, you see the rise of this individual, and we've looked at him before, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. But if you go down to verse number 6, we see here are the ancestors of Nimrod. It says in verse 6, and the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, and Phut, and Canaan, and the sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, so on and so forth. And you get down to verse number 8, and Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. So there's something about Nimrod that stood out. He became famous. He became mighty. He was powerful. And it looks like his power and his might were not natural. There was something supernatural about him, as you see from the rest of this portion of Scripture. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. You know, in other words, like a ruler, a leader, someone with power, someone with the ability to control the masses in a sense. And like kings, like dictators, that and that sort of might and sort of strength. It says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And before here doesn't mean in front of, but actually against. He was a mighty hunter against the Lord. In other words, his plans were contrary to what the obvious will of God was at that time. Now, men couldn't go out and pick up a Bible and find out what God's will was. They were dependent upon what had been handed down through Noah and Shem, the descendants of Noah. But it was clear, since God had spoken to Noah, that he wanted Noah and his descendants to replenish the earth, that was God's plan. And so Nimrod, in some way, has his own will. And that he's a perfect picture of the Antichrist, the willful king, the one whose will is more important to him than the will of God, his own plan. So he's contrary, he's against, he was a hunter, but he's a hunter contrary against the will of God. Just by the way, I want to show you, just hold your finger there and go over with me to 2 Kings chapter 16, because the Bible does define its own terms, and 2 Kings chapter 16. The Lord, there's a little verse here that just shows you that sometimes in the King James Bible, the word against and the word before are synonymous. They're interchangeable. All right. If you go to 2 Kings chapter 16, verse 11, that's interesting. 16:11 there. 2 Kings 16:11. It's talking about Urijah. The priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah, the priest, made it against King Ahaz, came from Damascus. You know, that verse doesn't seem to make, that phrase at the end doesn't seem to make any sense. It says that Urijah, the priest, Ahaz, the king, had gone abroad and seen this idolatrous altar that he admired, made by in Damascus. It was the altar dedicated to Jupiter, and Ahaz was God's king here, but he liked what he had seen when he saw that idolatrous altar, and so he told his high priest Urijah, "Make me one like that." Now God had already given directions to Moses what the altar in the temple was supposed to look like. In the tabernacle and then in the temple. But Ahaz wanted to, he liked what he saw in the world, and he wanted to bring the world into the church. And he says, give me an altar like that. And so he told Urijah, build me an altar like that. And they took the other small altar that was in the temple, and they moved it on the side. And Ahaz said, well, that'll be my own private personal altar. I'll have my personal devotions over there. But when the people of Israel come to offer to the Lord, I want them to do so on this altar like the one in Damascus. So he brought this worldly, idolatrous idea into the church, and he told his high priest, build me one like that, and he wanted it done quick. And it says And Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah the priest made it against King Ahaz came from Damascus. What does that verse sound like when you just interchange against with before? Then the verse makes sense. It says, so Urijah the priest made it before King Ahaz came from Damascus. So in other words, he made it quick. The king was coming. I got to have it done. He's going to be here soon. So he built it in a hurry before the king got there, because the king wanted to see it when he arrived. But it's just an indication. When we read this a couple of weeks ago, Margaret and I were talking about this verse. It's like, that's a strange place for the word against. And that is when I thought of the other verse in Genesis, that these two words are sometimes interchangeable in the scriptures. So Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord, but it doesn't mean in front of the Lord or ahead of the Lord. It means against the Lord. So back to Genesis. So Nimrod is this evil kind of an emperor, a dictator, who sets up a kingdom of his own contrary to the will of God, against the will of God. Verse number 9 in Genesis 10, it says, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. So it's obvious, even people that knew that about him, he was a rebel. He was the 13th from Adam, and that number in the scriptures is always the 13th generation from Adam, and that number is always associated with rebellion. And that's exactly what he was. He was a rebel against the will of God. But he was a very mighty and powerful individual, and he set up this kingdom, like the Antichrist will do, contrary to the will of God. But notice what his kingdom was like. We'll skip down here and just see this. Verse number, chapter 11, verse 1. And the whole earth was of one language and one speech. So communication was real easy. It was easy for everybody to be able to communicate with one another. A man like Nimrod, an Antichrist, needs that. It makes a world empire possible. It's absolutely essential for the communication to be this simple. And so it sort of facilitated this man to build a kingdom on such a huge scale, because everybody had the same language. It says, verse 2, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. That's in current where Iraq would be today. So right there in the Middle East. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower. And we've talked about that before. Nimrod's kingdom was both a center of economics and commerce. That would be represented by the city. But he also built a tower. The tower had no economic purpose. It was for religion. It was for worship, false worship. They were going to worship the stars. They were going to worship the gods that men had worshipped on the other side of the flood. Those angels that had come down from heaven. In the book of Genesis, chapter 6, it talks about the sons of God, the angels, the fallen angels that came down from heaven, and they were worshipped. They lived on the earth. That's the basis for all of the mythology today. All the Greek and Roman gods and Zeus and Mars and all these stories, and everybody loves to go see Hercules and all this stuff. And all of that is rooted in reality. I mean, it's mythology and it's fantastic. It's all been twisted, but it's rooted in something that really happened on the other side of the flood. And the memory of that, the knowledge of that, was still around. Nimrod knew about it. So in this new city that he builds, this kingdom that he builds, he's not setting up an altar so that he can worship the Lord, but he's building a tower so that he can worship those gods that he had heard about from the other side of the flood. So his kingdom is both economic and religious. The Antichrist has to harness both of those things. He has to control religion, and he also has to control the economy and the military. And there have been two great religions in history that have done that. Roman Catholicism and Islam have been both religious and military. And but notice it says here, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. So in other words, when there's that, when communication is that easy, and when they're of one mind in a sense, and one language, and they have these things that are all common between them, then it makes something like Nimrod set up very simple to do. But that was not God's will. So God came down and because it wasn't time for an Antichrist to set up a world kingdom yet. And that's the main reason for the Lord doing this. I mean, in heaven, we're going to have one language again. It'll be one kingdom again. There'll be one king. And there'll be that instant communication. But it wasn't time for man to do that on the earth. It had to wait for the Antichrist. So the Lord came down, verse number 8, and the Lord scattered them abroad, and he confused all of their languages. Verse 7, let's go down and confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So now all of a sudden you have people that can't understand each other. And obviously after a short period of time, people begin to gravitate around those that they can communicate with, and they end up going off, and that's where the migrations of all the nations began from that point. By the way, I was showing somebody this the other day. I was just trying to study to see the names of nations that are mentioned in the Bible. What are those nations today? Where are those places and peoples today? Because some of these, it's hard to know. Like, where was Togarmah? Where was Gomer? Where is, you know, so on and so forth. Where is Magog and all of that? And so I just started making my own little table of nations from Genesis 10 and 11. And then just trying to find out from the sources that I had to, you know, where are they today? Who are those people today? And I came across this website that traces the DNA of the various races. And that wouldn't have been possible until the last 30 years. But you can actually, they've actually now begun to map the DNA of the various races. Like, for example, the Book of Mormon claims that the American Indians were Hebrews, were Jews. The Book of Mormon makes that claim, right? Am I not correct? That the American Indians were really Jews that all got on boats and migrated over here in the days before Jesus. And that when Jesus came to the earth, he actually came to the Americas and preached to the Indians because they were his people, the Jewish people. The only problem is that I forget the guy's name who wrote the Book of Mormon. What was his name? Joseph Smith. Wrote that in the 1800s, long before DNA was possible. But of course now when, you know, Indians' DNA is checked, there is no connection to the Hebrews in any way, shape, or form. So it was obviously, as we knew anyway, it was a lie. But DNA proves it a lie. But when they've mapped like the DNA characteristics of various people groups around the world, they actually have been able to trace their source. You can trace the source of a people's DNA back to their ancestors and the ancestors before them and so on and so forth. And this map that I saw, you know where the origin of it all is? Now, these are unbelieving scientists that did this. It all traces back to a source in the Middle East, right around where present-day Iraq is. Right what the Bible said all along. From the plains of Shinar, when God distributed them and scattered them and confused them. Now the migrations began. And those bloodlines now are able to be traced, but only in this last, only since DNA has been, since we've been able to study that. But I thought that was pretty interesting. I showed it to one of our men. They can actually get a map and see it. All just traces right back to that part of the world. But anyway, so the people's language was one. I know where I wanted to take you. Go with me to Acts chapter 17. So the fact that the nations had a common language, had a common ruler, had a common kingdom, were all, you'd think that unity is a good thing, right? I mean, you'd think that, you know, unity, that must be God's in favor of unity. Like everything should be, you know, we should all be getting together. But you see that that's not always God's will, because in some things the nations are supposed to be separate. God keeps them kept them separate on purpose. In Acts chapter 17, let's go down there to Paul was in Athens, and he's speaking to a bunch of liberal philosophers here. This could have taken place in Union Square right here in New York because, you know, the attitudes are the same. These are men just filled with their own knowledge and their own wisdom, with a complete ignorance of God and the truth. And Paul is preaching to them on Mars Hill. And he's explaining to them what the Lord is really like. They have all their idolatrous ideas about who God is and what he's like. And Paul saw all these numerous images that were here in Athens to all these various gods, and he saw them that they had one image to the unknown God. And it was their habit that they didn't want to offend a God. If there was one out there that they didn't know about, maybe there's a God that we haven't been told about, and the Athenians just wanted to make sure that they didn't offend a God that was out there, and so they made an image to the unknown God. And meaning, we might not know your name, but here's an image for you too, and we're going to worship you as well. And so Paul simply took that as an opportunity to preach to them. And he latched on to that idea that this is an unknown God. And so he said, well, let me make that unknown God known to you. And he began to talk to them about the truth, about the Lord. And in so doing, he's talking in verse number 28. It says, for in him, this God that the Athenians were ignorant of, in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own prophets have said, for we are also his offspring. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, meaning all of us were created by God, he wasn't telling them we're all children of God, but we were all made by God, it was one God that made us all, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto God, gold or silver or stone graven by art or man's device. And the times of this ignorance... Wait, did I miss the verse that I'm looking for? I think I missed the verse. I skipped it by one verse. Go back up there. I got ahead of myself. Verse number 26, that's where I'm looking. So he's talking about the nations, verse 26. And hath made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth, because flowing in every man's veins, no matter if he's black or white or yellow, it doesn't matter. He's made the same way on the inside. Made us of all of one blood, all to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed, and the bounds of their habitation. All right, so even though God went down at Babel and confused their languages and scattered those people so that they would migrate as they eventually did, God determined, it's not an accident that the nations settled where they settled. God determined the boundaries of those habitations. God set that up and he had it in his mind. Even the times were appointed beforehand. So everything was in God's control. It says, but look at what the Lord, why the Lord did this. He before appointed the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord. That they should seek the Lord. So in other words, God had these nations, these peoples, to be separated one from another within their own boundaries, as a sense, because God intended to reach them. They would be more easily reached with the gospel. It, rather than being all homogenized in a blender and everybody of one language spread out all over the earth, God wanted those people groups separated for a reason. That God could bring the gospel to them within the bounds, within the confines of those boundaries. So in other words, God did it for the sake ultimately of the gospel, that they should seek the Lord. If happily they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. So all I'm trying to point out from that is the contrast to the days of Nimrod. Nimrod had wanted everybody to have one language, one instant kind of communication. The people were all one. The kingdom was one. One leader. But living in a world as we do today with national interests and national sovereignties, hundreds of different languages, different currencies, different laws. It was necessary for an Antichrist to be able to come and set up a kingdom on a global scale. The technology that you and I have in our homes and in our pockets right now was absolutely necessary. It would not have been possible for someone to do that unless these things were available as they are right now. And you think about how much of our lives today are controlled and influenced by the technology that we have in our homes and in our pockets. The television alone is probably the single greatest influence on our culture. Kids are raised on it. We buy the cereal we buy and brush our teeth with the stuff we do because we saw it on a television show. I mean, we are influenced more than we realize. We eat the foods we do and we dress the way we do because the world has put that in front of us to a big degree and said, this is what you should eat, this is how you should look, this is the way you should think, this is... And it's fed into our brains and it gets into our hearts. And you know what it is? If you think about it, most of it more and more is visual. It's visual. Your eyes are being entertained. You can sit in front of a movie screen, you can sit in front of a television, and you know what? You almost turn your brain off for a little while. You ever gotten up from a couple of hours in front of the television set and you're sore? You haven't done anything but just sit there like a lump on a couch. But you ever notice how sometimes you feel tired after, you know, because your body maybe you haven't been getting any exercise, but your brain and your mind have been bombarded with information, and it's wearying. It's wearying to an individual. But you know what this book is? There's no pictures in here. It's not in Technicolor. I don't know what the refresh rate, you know, the pixel thing in here and all that sort of stuff. I mean, nowadays you can't have a, you know, I don't even understand, you know, somebody said to me the other day about getting a TV downstairs. We did buy a big screen TV for the fellowship hall downstairs. Yes, we did. We didn't install it yet, but we're getting, little by little, getting some things ready for next year's anniversary. But... So we're talking about refresh rates and pixel this and that, and it's like, I have no idea what in the world you're talking about. Plasma, LCD, I don't know. You might know and really like care about all the fine, you know, the minutia, all the details between those things, and you would probably abhor the idea of going back to some technology that was 2 or 3 years old or 4 years old. Because we got to have the best. We got to have the biggest. It's got to be crystal clear. It's got to look like the people are going to walk off that screen and just sit down with us and eat. I mean, you know, now, like, some of these things, now they've even gone beyond HD. I don't even know what it's called. But, like, you can see, like, the hair follicles on football players on the game. It's like, it's crazy. Why do we need that? Because it's possible. It's possible for men to do it. And whatever's possible. Remember what it said in Genesis chapter 10? If it's possible, men are going to just attempt to try and do it. And so, but it's just all part of that, men, that it's just part of the devil, I think, just allowing, just setting the world up for that global kingdom that's coming. You think about it. All the things that are a part of our lives that we take for granted that were not a part of our grandparents' lives. The television, cell phones, computers, the telescopes that we have now, what's the name of the Hubble telescope that can see like into galaxies that people didn't even knew existed before? The internet, the speed of travel. I still marvel sometimes that I can get on a plane in New York and in 17 hours be on the other side of the globe. Get off that plane in Seoul, Korea or the Philippines or somewhere like that when... This is all possible for the most part in our generation. Now, this gets bizarre, and I don't know much about it, but I remember one time watching a special, a documentary on nanotechnology. So if you're a geek, maybe you know about that sort of stuff. I'm not sure what that is. But nanotechnology is like building on the microscopic level. We're using nanotechnology. They have glass on the sides of buildings now that cleans itself. They have fiber that is made in a laboratory that's as strong as steel, that's flexible like cloth, but as strong as steel. And like from this documentary that I saw, like, the future is just unlimited. What can be done? You know, what are they going to be able to do with that? So the technology is just incredible. Space travel, all in our generation, going into outer space. You know, say, well, yeah, okay, we've been, you know, been there, done that. But just stop and put it all in perspective. Daniel said that at the time of the end, knowledge would increase, but increase to the level where it's almost a sign of his coming. And we obviously see that all around us. All right? Okay. I think I'm going to stop there. We're not going to go on to number 17. There's just no way to begin that one. But I'll tell you what it is. 17 has to do with disease, plagues, AIDS, Ebola, viruses, the health issues, the way our world and our own personal health is changing, GMOs and all that stuff. You can get into all kinds of conspiracy stuff when you start talking about GMOs. But the way that your food and our food is chemically altered and changed, and where and there's a whole lot of stuff that is all a part of just preparing the world for disease and virus and plagues. The Bible speaks about plagues and pestilences that kill people by the millions in the last days. So does that just come out of nowhere all of a sudden? No, if those verses are going to be fulfilled, and we know they will, then we will in our lifetime see the beginnings of that, you know, see the foundations of that beginning. And so we'll talk about that next Wednesday night. Okay? All right. Well, that's it for now. All right. Thanks for your attention tonight. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you this evening, Lord, that